Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we're on stage left at Catherine Party Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you this morning?
Doing smashingly.
You know, I want to talk today about a fairly serious topic. We actually have coming up on the show, we're going to talk about cage-free eggs with one of the country's top producers of cage-free eggs. And then at the end of the show, we're going to have a call in to talk with Dr. Stephen Witherly, who's a food scientist who studies how your brain perceives flavor.
One of my favorite guests.
To talk about one of your favorite foods, eggs. So it's
the incredible
edible egg show today. If that's trademarked, we take it back.
I'm sure that it's trademarked.
We only mean it in a good way then. But before that, I want to talk about a topic that, you know, really affects the food industry. And there have been some pieces recently on a new trend where it, in response to the shortage of labor as we crack down on the border, and I think people need to remember this. You know, people say, oh, there aren't jobs that no Americans would take. There are, and they're farm jobs.
And the other thing about this that I want to point out is, and there always have been.
Yeah.
There has, for as long as this country has been on top and successful, we've had an immigrant population doing jobs that Native Americans, and I don't mean that in
as well, not Native Americans, but right.
People who've been here for a few generations have not wanted to do as they've become more affluent, and then that group becomes more affluent as well.
And so.
And a new immigrant population comes in and takes on some of the jobs that the more affluent people are unwilling to do.
And we have so many immigrants in this country, and many of them undocumented, that if you sent them all back to wherever they came from, this country came from, you have already, because of the tightening control on the border from migrant workers in Mexico, you have the pear crop. Last year it was a bumper crop. Oh, well, it would have been a bumper crop, except they didn't have the workers to pick the pears off the trees.
So most of the pears rotted on the trees.
Remained
unpicked, and farmers were unable to pick their farm. Realize that you have a farm, and maybe two, three, four, five people work on your family farm with you, and all of a sudden...
It's harvest time,
and your entire crop comes in.
And you need a crew of 60 pickers. Okay, and the thing is, every day you're not out there, you have a certain number of days to get your crop in, mm-hmm. and then after that, you know, you've got a few days to get in your pears, and then your pears rot and they're no good.
And your neighbors can't help you, and your neighbors' kids can't help you, and your neighbors' friends can't help you because they're all picking at their farms. If you're in a farming community, all those people are working on their own farms for that time period.
And we don't have Americans who can come in and give up whatever job they're doing or remain unemployed, you know, 7 months a year. We need people who are willing to be migrant workers, which is to move where the work is as mm-hmm. different things become ripe throughout the season. And if you don't have them, I mean, I don't know. It's very hard. We have a large Mexican community in New Brunswick. Mm-hmm. We don't hire undocumented workers. Our workers have all proven to us that they have, you know, Social Security numbers and that they're legal aliens. If you were to drive out this immigrant population, some of them are getting their visas, their work visas. We've sponsored a couple of people over the years, not too many, because it's an arduous process. If they were to leave, who would do the work? Now let's talk about how the market reacts to that. Well, a lot of those pear farmers who didn't pull in their crop, now they had a bad year last year.
Mm-hmm.
This year the
but
pears...
But because of weather, not because of...
Right.
Of
this year they had a good year, but they couldn't get them picked. Many of those pear farms in California are going out of business.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to be farms next year. And now in California, what you're finding is that many larger U.S. farmers...
Just one thing I want to interject.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, realize in a lot of areas, okay, New Jersey is a prime area. I was just out in Long Island farm country. The North Fork has a lot of great farm country. Let's take Long Island as a prime example. That farmland is much more valuable as vacation homes,
as some other type of corporate center, as a parking lot. That farmland is much more
and if they can't,
has much more dollar value to the person who owns it than their farm.
And if they can't get migrant workers in there to pick their crops cannot get picked.
And when you're talking about what are my choices? My choices are to go bankrupt or to sell off part of my property to one of these concerns.
Part of the property, the old property.
Or all the property, exactly.
Because if you can't get migrant workers in to pick the crops, you can't get the crops picked. Now, here's what's happening. There's an article in the Times by Julia Preston. She writes about Steve Sarcone, a farmer from California who was down in Mexico. He's been farming since he was a teenager in America. He had a $50 million business growing lettuce and broccoli in the fields of California and relying on the hands of immigrant workers, most of them Mexicans and many probably in the United States illegally, even though they showed improper paperwork. But early last year, he began shifting his operation to rented fields in Mexico. Now some 500 Mexicans tend his crops in Mexico, where they run no risk of deportation. He says, this is the farmer, I'm as American red blood as it gets, but I'm tired of fighting the fight on the immigration issue. He's moving the farm to Mexico.
Now, my belief, and I'm not sure where Francis stands on this, is I believe that as people enter this country, that there needs to be a legal process for which they can do it.
I agree.
But we need to allow a certain amount of immigrants into this country in order to continue some of the practices that have made this country what it is.
Right. I mean, I think morally as well. I mean, my ancestors were Irish immigrants who came in.
And mine were Italian Americans.
And they didn't.
Were Italian immigrants first before they were Italian.
And they weren't. I don't think they were documented either. You know. But in any event, wherever you stand on that, let's talk about it from who's going to pick the fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have nobody to pick the fruit, we can still get the fruit. But this whole locavore movement.
It's over.
You know, right now we have. On the Senate floor, there was a map shown that shows more than 46,000 acres that American growers are cultivating now in just the two Mexican states, Baja California and the one next to it. Our farmers are taking the farms out of the country because if you make it impossible for them to farm here, well, then they got to go elsewhere. And then you're not producing any food domestically. So I just think that we should have a broader perspective on this immigration issue. And I'm not saying there's an easy answer, but I'm saying we have to have an answer. And just shutting the borders and throwing everybody out cannot be the answer. It has to be more complex than that. We do need to secure the borders. We do need a safe country. We do need to make sure that that workers have rights and are protected. But we need to have a balance.
And I'm not exactly sure how to attain that balance. I don't claim I don't claim to have all the answers. But anybody who doesn't understand that the immigrant workforce is an important part of our economy, and frankly, sub-economy, okay, when you're talking about migrant farm workers and some of the people who are currently undocumented, I think that what we need to do is find a way to document those people, the people who are working hard, making a living, and helping keep things run in our country.
And just one other thing. When people say, a lot of the people say, oh, well, farmers should just mechanize. If you can't mechanize all farming operations. Mm-hmm. If you could, they would. It wouldn't be about immigration. It's cheaper to mechanize. But you can't develop a machine that knows a good piece of fruit from a bad piece of fruit or a good head of lettuce from a bad head of lettuce. So you can't have quality. And without the quality, we can't have the farms and we can't have the markets. Hey, let's go and talk about quality with a guy who produces really top quality eggs, and then we'll talk with another guy about why they taste really good. Back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC, it's 1115. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, at Stage Left in Cafe Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is John Brunquell. He's a leading expert in the United States egg industry. He's the president of Egg Innovations, a family farm operation held by his family for three generations. His company is 100% cage-free, and he delivers eggs to A&P, Whole Foods, and other major food chains. And he joins us to discuss the growing popularity and controversy about the way we treat our poultry.
John, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Perhaps you could tell us exactly what cage-free means. Why don't we start
with that? It strikes me that eggs don't run away. You wouldn't need to put them in a cage.
The term cage-free, it's actually a very good question because there really isn't a regulatory body that gives a defined this is what it means. And so it falls a lot on third-party certifiers. We use one called Humane Farmed Animal Care, that we try and be as transparent as we can what it means at Egg Innovations. What it means to us is no cages, a specific amount of area per bird, and it moves beyond just cages into our whole approach to animal welfare.
Let's talk about cage. I think people who listen to our show, and we've had Adele Douglas from Humane Farm Animal Care on the show, people who listen to our show are sort of sensitive to the idea of what we do wrong with our chickens and what battery cages are for chickens. Why don't you, for those who might not be familiar with it, why don't you talk to us about what cage-free, how raising a chicken cage-free is different from the way most chickens are raised, and what exactly battery cages are?
There's about 270 million chickens in the United States that produce eggs every day for what we call the table egg market, and that's whether it's restaurants or grocery stores. And out of that 270 million, about 95% of them are raised in cages. And so we can talk about that 95% being the very typical egg. And as in anything cage-free or caged, I don't want to imply that all cage producers are bad and all cage-free producers are good. It's certainly a function of the individual management. But probably the biggest contrasts are in a caged environment, a chicken's going to get about the space of a square sheet of paper.
I mean, my dad had a farm when we were kid, when I was a kid, and we had a chicken coop on that farm, and they were caged in. So, I mean, aren't all chickens caged? I mean, isn't that part of the deal?
Well, if you go back, the cage phenomena really began around right after World War II. In fact, I have a gentleman who works with me who's actually 84 years old, and he was in the Battle of the Bulge, and he chuckles every day because he looks at this market emerging, and he goes, you know, John, this is just what I was doing back when it was normal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And now cage-free seems to be a trend per se.
Now, what are the objections that those who object to caging eggs, and what's driving the consumer demand for cage-free eggs? What are the objections that people have to raising chickens in cages that they don't have in a cage-free operation?
The biggest ones are space, very clearly. The industry will tend to say we view it from a scientific point of view, and the science that the industry will cite is very specific production science, meaning, well, look, if the chicken is laying an egg, it must be healthy. And I certainly believe there's a role for behavioral science. When you walk in one of our barns and you see the birds socialize with their peers, they can stretch their wings, they can dust bathe, those are very normal animal activities that are not offered to them in a caged environment.
So what you're saying is that, and this is radical, when we talk about a cage, I read somewhere that one of the groups that is touting the amount of space that a cage gets, they insist that every cage bird, depending on the size, the style of the cage and the bird, gets between 67 and 86 cubic inches of space, which is, like you said, about like
a piece of paper.
A piece of paper. So in that environment, if a chicken never gets to turn around or do anything that's normal to a chicken, the stress level in chickens, I mean, has to go. It's just cruel. It's just unnatural. It's just wrong, isn't it?
There's several things that we measure. One of the precursors to cholesterol is sterol measurements in the blood, and certainly you can measure those at a higher level in a caged environment than a cage-free environment. And very clearly, when you look at flavor.
I was going to say, let's talk about this selfishly. Let's talk about how the egg tastes as in, you know, difference between a cage-free egg and a non-cage-free egg.
Well, I don't eat a lot of my competitors' products. I can only speak for Egg Innovations, but the taste is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And going back more seriously, in animal products, milk, meat, and eggs, there's a direct correlation between exercise and movement of the bird and flavor. And that's why you see more range-fed beef, cage-free eggs, those types of things. Because the muscles that you're either eating in the form of a steak or the muscles that are producing the product in the form of milk or eggs, that exercise imparts flavor through a bioprocess that is very significant. The other thing that happens in the cage-free side, which is not specific to cage-free, is it tends to be associated with a brown egg.
Mm-hmm.
And a brown egg will inherently have a somewhat higher fat content than a white egg.
Why is that?
That's just the breed of the bird and the genetics that go with that.
You know, we need to take a break for a commercial, but when we come back, I really want to talk to you about egg labeling and some of the labels that we see currently on our egg cartons.
1450 WCTC, it's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking with John Brunquell. He is one of the leading experts in America on cage-free eggs, which are seeing a huge increase in demand.
So, John, in answer to the label, some of the labels we've seen on our eggs, I was in the supermarket just the other day, and I saw a label, and it said United Egg Producers Certified, and there's a big check mark and a label on it. And it says, produced in compliance with United Egg Producers Animal Husbandry Guidelines. Can you tell me what that means?
I can tell you in general, the United Egg Producers, of which we're a member, has had to take a position on animal welfare in response to major corporate people such as Kroger, McDonald's, et cetera. And in the United Egg Producer program, they measure things such as square inches per bird, ammonia level of the building, which is birds tend to be in an ammonia environment. There's a practice in cage production called debeaking or beak trimming, and they measure the age at which birds do those types of activities. And so it's a measurement of various animal activities. The one thing that we always caution people a little bit about in the United Egg Producer program is, as we sit here today, they're currently formulating cage-free standards, but they do not have any. So, for instance, my United Egg Producer standard for my cage-free birds is being compared to a cage standard, which obviously we meet pretty easily.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it strikes me that well, I think I read somewhere that 80% of the egg producers in America are entitled to this label, which is the United Egg Producer Certified, which is sort of like, you know, as about as difficult as graduating the second grade. You know, you sort of show up and you get it. So, this strikes me, just because I'm always interested from a consumer's perspective, this strikes me as a smokescreen. Because if someone isn't as well acquainted with all the different gradations, that they say, okay, well, this means it's humanely raised. When it doesn't mean the same thing as a humane farm animal care certification.
The thing that we always tell consumers, and we try and do it as best we can ourselves, is look for companies that are absolutely transparent in their animal welfare standards. For instance, ours are posted on our website.
You know, and that's some good advice. And also look for, you know, ask your grocer and check things out online. Hey, listen, we need to take a break for the news. We'll be back afterwards to talk more about poultry, hens, and cage-free eggs, which are sweeping the nation in demand. 1450 WCTC, it's 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back.
You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and here with Pizza Shop. To get a meal steak left at Captain Party Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey, we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
We're talking today with John Brunquell. He's a leading expert in the United States egg industry. He's president of Egg Innovations, a family farm operation that his family's held for 3 years. His company is 100% cage-free and has a certification from Humane Farm Animal Care. You may remember Humane Farm Animal Care. The president of that group, Adele Douglas, did an interview with us that you can find on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, to learn more about this kind of issue. But it's a complex world that we're entering into, and we talk about another certification that's given out by the egg industry to a lot of people, called the United Egg Producers Certified. And it's hard as a consumer to sort of see through it. You know, John,
Wade through all this information and disinformation.
We talked about being transparent before, but it's hard for a consumer to, you know, you're in the supermarket, you're shopping, and you see two sets of eggs, and one says Humane Farm Animal Care Certified Cage Free, and the other says United Egg Producers Certified, produced in compliance with United Egg Producers Animal Husbandry Guidelines. And, you know, most people don't have the time to go and look up their egg producer online. So I think there's a lot of misleading information out there.
Francis and I are looking for some transparency.
But even if it's transparent, I mean, who has time to check? How do you fight through, and you're in Whole Foods and you're in A&P, how do you get your message heard so that people know that you're the real deal?
You have an excellent point, and as the growth of specialty eggs occurs, there's a little bit of like the Wild West mentality. There are companies that play around with labels and claims and the things as such. And while it may sound fairly boring and tedious, the best thing we can do is through our website and through our labeling is clarify for people what does cage-free mean at Egg Innovations. We can't really speak to a competitor and what they may have for their cage-free standards or anything else, but what we can do is we can be very explicit that here's what we stand for. You may or may not be interested in buying our product, but we will post it all publicly. This is what you're going to get when you buy it. And that, other than, you know, advertising and the like, is the best we can do, other than to, of course, the associated groups, Humane Farmed Animal Care and the others that are advocates for animal welfare, also provide information.
So cage-free eggs are more expensive.
Clearly.
Okay, they're more expensive to produce. Is the only reason that they're more expensive to produce the space that you're giving the birds?
No, one of the other core values of Egg Innovations is we support family farms. And so right now there's 30 typically Amish family farms in Indiana that produce for us. And so one of our goals is a sustainable income. And so our typical farmer will make about $70,000 or $80,000 a year tending a barn for us. And that's very clearly a much higher cost than a person punching a clock at $7 or $8 an hour in a factory farm.
Mm-hmm.
Very clearly at the retail level, margins are different on specialty eggs as opposed to conventional eggs.
Well, sure, because it takes – because, for instance, now we own a restaurant. We own a couple of restaurants. I know, and I grew up in an industry where when you wanted to get your tomatoes and peaches and whatever the heck you wanted the next day, you called up a major food distributor the night before and you said, deliver me 10 boxes of this, 4 boxes of this, 3 boxes of that, 2 boxes of that. You left it in the answering machine. And when you came in, it was there the next day. Well, it's more difficult for me to think, okay, next week should be the last week for Silver Queen corn, and so I'll carry it next week, but then I got to, you know, rejigger what I'm going to carry the following week. I think whenever you carry a specialty product with a higher cost and it's a more difficult distribution network, you're going to have to pay a little more for it.
We would agree.
Now, you talked about the Amish. A lot of the farmers that you use out in Indiana are Amish farmers. Indiana are the Amish community. And what was happening to the Amish community? Were they being forced off their farms?
We don't preclude anyone who's not Amish. It just seems that that's where the majority of our farms have come from. What our focus is, family farms. And so all of our producers, if you were out at a farm, you'd see a husband and a wife and the family participating in chores and producing eggs. The challenge that Middle America has in agriculture, whether it's animals or whether it's crops, is the consolidation. And so a family farm is looking for ways to be involved in the value-added market and be able to have an income that allows them to stay there and not work off farm. And so I would say with a little bit of humility, we've been a positive influence in northern Indiana. The economy, the amount of farms that have been involved in our program, and, of course, the allied people that, whether they provide feed or supporting services.
I think that that's one of the reasons that people feel fine about paying a little more for cage-free eggs, especially if they know that they're going to support family farms. We know that, at least for now, in the value-added market of, you know, eating locally or eating humanely raised foods, it's family farms are more likely and more able to do that than large agribusiness. And, you know, there are limits to the free market. If the free market, if the most efficient thing free market-wise is for all of our farms to go away and be owned by, you know, five major companies and for us to lose the face of the family farm in America,
it doesn't mean that's the best decision.
I don't think that's the best thing, exactly. And so I think there's a huge value in America to having our food produced from diverse sources and to have such a thing as a family farm. I think it's central to the core values of the country.
You know, we touched on this a little bit earlier, John, but I want to get into it just a little deeper. Kim Severson wrote an article for the New York Times a little while back, and one of the things that she asserted is companies can be granted the label cage-free without getting inspected, their facilities being inspected. How does a consumer know who's really taking this seriously and who's not?
Our opinion is that unless you see a animal welfare third-party certification, and we really only know of one, the Humane Farmed Animal Care Program, you do not have a third-party audit assurance.
So what's that going to look like?
It's going to be a picture, a logo that kind of looks like a little barn and farm, you know, sitting on a horizon line.
Now, one of the practices that people find particularly disturbing when they hear about it is called either beak trimming or debeaking birds. Does that happen in a cage-free operation? Does that happen in your operation? And if so, what is there an appropriate role for it in raising chickens?
What the issue is that chickens are inherently and genetically cannibalistic if they are put under stress environments. And so what the industry has done is they've made it a habit to nip off the tip of the beak because it has a hook on it, similar to a raptor. And so when done properly, it blunts the hook and makes it round. When done improperly, it can be very negative. In the Humane Farmed Animal Care Program, that is done at a very young age. It's a beak trimming, and it just simply rounds off the hook. In other programs, or if you're not on a program, people may do it at a much later age, or they may do it more than one time with a bird.
And is it painful to the bird in any circumstance?
Done at the right age, it would be similar to your child getting a shot.
Mm-hmm. You know,
but to contrast, if it's done later, it is painful to the bird.
Yes.
You know, in psychology class, I mean, it was probably my 100 or 200 level psychology classes. One of the things that you learn is when animals get into very, very close confinement, they get very, very stressed and they exhibit behaviors that they would not normally exhibit and almost always become more violent. You don't need to be an expert in this field to realize that this is not a natural living condition and that it's not healthy.
I mean, would you agree with that?
I grew up in the caged environment. I grew up on a very classic small family farm with all cages.
Mm-hmm.
And very clearly, we've moved entirely to cage-free. And that's probably the strongest statement I can make.
I think that's great. Hey, listen, John, it's been great of you to come on the show with us. Your insights are really helpful, and we'll have people look for your eggs when they're out there in the markets.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks very much, John.
1450 WCTC, it's 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis from the Restaurant Guys. We were talking with John Ronquillo in the last part of the show and about eggs and his cage-free egg operation. But, you know, eggs are a magic food, and there's a reason we're so attracted to eggs. They're the basic structure of a lot of our food, and they embody a lot of the things that we as humans really like about food. We've called up our friend Dr. Stephen Witherly, whose book, Why Humans Like Junk Food, he's our favorite food scientist, to ask him why we are so fascinated with eggs and what role eggs play in human taste. Dr. Witherly.
Hello, guys. Well, eggs are an interesting compound. First of all, they're very complete in nutrition. And being complete in nutrition, the body recognizes all the fat, all the protein, all the carbohydrates in an egg. So it's a very desirable from a nutritional standpoint. And that way, the body looks at the egg as being something very desirable. And number two, and probably overlooked, is the egg is an amazing natural emulsifier. And as we learned that humans like emulsions, and what's the best way to create emulsion? Egg yolk.
Maybe you should explain to everybody what an emulsion is.
Okay, well, an emulsion is when you take water and you take oil and you mix it together, they don't mix. So you need something to throw in there that mixes oil and water together, and that's called an emulsifier. And some of our favorite foods are emulsions. For example, a mayonnaise is a oil and water emulsion, and it's done by egg yolks. So it makes some of the tastiest foods ever. If you can master an emulsion using egg yolks, you are getting close to being a good home cook and a great chef, because hollandaise sauces, béarnaise sauces, all depend on making egg yolks work.
I was in France recently, and I went to a great little bistro, and one of the best dishes I had, which was, it was lovely. It was a pea soup, kind of a thicker pea soup, and set in the pea soup was a poached egg with the yolk barely set. It was probably set by the heat of the soup.
Right, right.
And then on top of that, they put some crunchy bacon. So you put your spoon through the crunchy bacon, and you broke the egg yolk at that point, which sort of went bleh into the soup, and you had this, like, crunch of the bacon, and you could tell the difference in texture and temperature between the egg yolk, which was just a little warmer than room temperature, and the hot soup. Why was that one of the most wonderful experiences I've had all year?
That sounds great. It's making me hungry here.
it is almost lunchtime.
Egg yolks are loaded with compounds called phospholipids. And phospholipids are very taste-active compounds. And what they do is they like to interact with other things. So if you have a phospholipid and you add salt to it, it makes the salt kind of shoot out. If you take egg yolks and you add sugar to it, like a creme brulee, it makes the sugar stand out. So that's why egg yolks are my top 10 pleasure foods, because they make just about everything they touch taste better.
Well, you know, and the thing is that I found is very interesting is I love that texture of a barely set egg yolk. That is just the sexiest texture if you play that right in food. And, you know, it's one of those things that home cooks, you know, you really have to hit it right, because if you wait too long, it's hard, and if it's raw, it's raw. Why is that texture so appealing to me?
Well, the texture is appealing because what you just described is a phenomenon called dynamic contrast. When you're cooking an egg, it's very, very tricky, actually. French chefs, like, argue over, like, incessantly. But when you cook it just right, when you put it into your mouth, it melts down quickly and releases all the taste-type components at once. So you're precisely explaining how to cook the egg properly for the maximum pleasure.
You know, there are a lot of foods out there, and we separate eggs quite a bit, and certain the yolks go into certain foods, and the whites go into certain other foods, and we can talk about that in just a moment. But you sear a egg in butter or even olive oil, but especially in butter, just a simple sunny side up egg is one of the most pleasurable foods in the world, and there are very few people in the world who don't like that.
That's correct. One of the other things that people forget is that eggs are high in nutrients, and they're also high in fats, and they're also high in essential nutrients, essential fatty acids. And when those essential fatty acids go on your tongue, they react. They have receptors on your tongue that are looking just for essential fatty acids, and they are in the egg yolk.
What's an essential fatty acid? What function does it have?
It functions for cell membranes. Without essential fatty acids, we would all be dead in seconds. It is a fat. It's a linoleic acid and linolenic acid, and eggs are high in both. And you can even buy eggs that have something called docosahexaenoic acid, DHA. And your body recognizes that these things are so essential, and when they go in your tongue, they light up your brain, and your brain says, you just ate the right thing.
Now, you said some eggs have those. Do some eggs have them and some eggs not?
Yes, that's correct. For the essential fatty acids, linolenic and linoleic, all eggs have them. But the special eggs with DHA, you have to buy those at specialty stores.
Do you know offhand how they get them in there? Is it what they feed the chickens? Or?
That's exactly what they do. They feed the chicken, and there's 100 milligrams of that. And that particular fatty acid, DHA, the brain loves. And that's what I cook with at home, and that's why I feed my daughters. That special, those special eggs with DHA in it, they're just fabulous.
Are they smart? They make you smarter?
To be honest with you, there's studies showing that they can actually increase your memory, yes.
Really? And I can find these in the, I'm going out for, after
yeah,
lunch.
Yeah,
I didn't
absolutely.
Know about this.
I'm quite serious. I get mine at Costco.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And it says it right on the label.
Yeah.
What does it say? DHA?
It says added omega-3 fats. DHA.
And it's basically what they're feeding the chickens. It's really interesting and really delicious. And
yeah, they're more expensive, but that's what you want to be cooking with.
Dr. Stephen Whitley, I learn something new every time I talk to you. But my girlfriend thinks I'm crazy because I'm like, no, we have to buy those eggs now.
No, yeah. Those eggs will be crazy and smart.
Exactly. Well, they're not mutually exclusive, as we know. Hey, listen, thanks for coming on the show to talk to us about the sexy side of eggs.
Not a problem.
So you out there in listening land, you can have the sexy side of eggs and the responsible side of eggs.
And just so everyone knows, the sexy side of eggs and the responsible side of eggs are on the same side.
And a barely, remember, secret weapon in all your dishes, soups on top of mushrooms, on top of vegetables, a barely set egg yolk. Really remarkable. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC, it's 1155. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to Marcus Francis, the Restaurant Guys, talking about eggs today. Eggs.
You know, and we just did a short site. We talked with John Brunkwell at the beginning of the show, and we spoke with Dr. Stephen Whitley, who is going to be a regular guest on the Restaurant Guys whenever we have an appropriate topic. And I just want to remind everybody, we did a show with Dr. Steve a little while back where we decided we're going to do a dinner based on some of his theories of food pleasure. And why we like certain foods. And what we're going to do in that dinner is we are going to prepare certain foods based on some of Dr. Steve's principles. And then Steve's going to be at the dinner, and he's going to talk to you about what about those particular dishes you had.
How it lights up your brain.
How it lights up your brain, exactly.
Really amazing.
And it's spectacular. And in some of these cases, realize that Steve is a real PhD in food science, and what they're doing is they're looking at in animals and people how your brain functions and what happens and how certain pleasure centers in your brain light up when you eat foods like chocolate or caffeine or coffee or even eggs.
And Steve is a bit of a cult. There's a cultural anthropology bent to his view of things as well, and he looks back at history and culture as well. His book, by the way, is Why Humans Like Junk Food, The Inside Story on Why You Like Your Favorite Foods. We recommend it highly. You can find a link to it on our website. Matt, but, you know, eggs are one of the basic magic foods. He talked about them in sauces. We use egg whites in drinks. Do you know that here's a little drink trivia. You ready for a little drink trivia?
I love drink trivia. Right.
There was a fizz. Is classically like a Ramos fizz, is classically a drink that is served shaken with an egg white and then served without ice, chilled, but then poured off without ice, and then you hit it with a little bit of soda. The soda interacts with the egg white and makes it really fizzy. So that's a fizz. They also have drinks made with the whole egg, and those are called royal fizzes.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have drinks with just the egg
yolk. Egg yolk, some really, really delicious drinks.
They're called golden fizzes.
And egg yolks really can, and I know people are so afraid of raw eggs, but handled correctly, they'll be totally fine in some of these high alcohol drinks. Egg yolks can really enrich a drink and give it a texture like you wouldn't believe.
And in the wintertime, when it gets cold outside, you'll see us use egg yolks in drinks at Cafe Lombardi because they're wonderful, or even to make drinks out of batter. But that's for another show. I'm afraid we're out of time. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 12 noon.